Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. Today is Thursday, April 30th, the last day of April. Can you believe we're going to be in May tomorrow? I can't, but I'm glad we are going to be in May tomorrow. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2058, just so that we can have Representative Greenlich's testimony. He has been working in the interim on this bill for a long, long time. It's done some great work. But we'll get at least his testimony. Then I'm going to close that out and then open up 2194. But Representative Greenlich, please come forward.
Thank you, Senator, member of the committee. My name is Mitch Greenlich, State Representative of House District 33, and I'm really happy to be here. This is the first of a series of bills you're going to get from the Health Care Committee of the House. We spent a great deal of time in the interim looking at the question of the makeup and operation of the Health Professional Licensing Boards. We spent in the interim, then we got a new committee, so life got a little confused as to where we actually got. But I think you get about three or perhaps four bills from us that do specific things. One of the first things we found when we began looking at health licensing boards, and you found the same thing in your explorations of them in the past, is that there was no consistency in the statutes about a variety of things. Just as an example, one of the first things we found when there was a sort of chaos in one of the boards is that the governor didn't have the authority to remove board members. And when we looked over the 17 health licensing boards, we found in some cases the statute said the board served as at the pleasure of the governor. In some statutes, the statute said board members could only be removed for cause. In one statute, the statute said that a board member could only be removed when the board asked the governor to remove the board member. And in several cases, there was nothing in the statute about the removal of a board member. There was also some ambiguity about how a member could be appointed. So what we did with this bill, this particular bill, which doesn't change the makeup of any board, but it does try and regulate the Byzantine nature of the statutes, because the statutes came on one at a time. We didn't have 17 health professional statutes coming all together. So what this does is it moves all terms of the board members from 2 to 3 to 4 down to 3-year terms. We decided not to term limit the board members because some boards were anxious that we not term limits. It takes a while to get somebody up to speed on a board, and if they could convince the member to stay on, they wanted to be able to keep them on beyond that. All members are appointed by the governor, ratified, is that the term, by the Senate? That's not quite the confirmed by the Senate, and serve at the pleasure of the governor on all boards. And the governor is asked to consider geographic and ethnic diversity in appointing the board members. And basically, that's the changes that are in there. Speaking with the chair before, there are some changes we didn't make, but you may see them along the line because we took the bites as we could, and this bill was the harbinger coming through the process. The board does not change the membership proportions for any of the boards. We'll have another bill coming along that suggests adding one public member to every board. You'll see that one as it comes along. And this affects the Board of Psychologists, Examiners, the Occupational Therapy, the Board of Clinical Social Workers, Professional Counselors and Therapists, the Medical Board, the Board of Nursing, Nursing Home Administrators, Dentistry, Denture Technology, Speech Language Pathology, Audiology, optometry, chiropractic, naturopathic, direct entry midwife, PT board, radiology tech, respiratory, pharmacy, and dietitians. So I think that's all it does. I think when you look at the dark language, you'll find it does that. It standardizes the term limits. It takes away any term limits. It says the public members may not be directly related to a licensee of their board or license themselves. And it says all members serve at the pleasure of the governor. The governor considers geographic and ethnic diversity. And that's it.
That's great. I started going over this thoroughly, and the changes that you proposed, I don't have any problem with, but I think I talked to you a little bit before regarding who can serve on the board or not, and that's what I want to discuss with certain, I've asked certain boards to come forward. I'm not sure they're going to be here today, but I have gotten the message out to them.
Things in the original statutes that we did not change about that.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So any questions?
Okay. And as I say, look for two or three more we have coming. I think two more coming your way that were more contentious than this one. We didn't have much problem with this one in the House.
Excellent.
Thank you very much.
Thank
for
you.
Hearing
yeah.
me.
All right. I will temporarily close the public hearing on 2058, and I'd like to open a public hearing on 2194.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2194A modifies the definition of medical insurance for purposes of medical Oregon medical insurance pool.
And I need to find out who is on the witness registration form. Thank you very much. Okay, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. All right. let's call Bob Shipwreck. Well, no, let's call the... They're neutral. Let's call Ilana.
Rocky.
Oh, let's do Rocky. Rocky, you weren't
yeah.
even on here.
Rocky's got his hand up. He wants
Golly.
To testify.
Golly.
Sitting in the front row.
Rocky's here. Let's start with you, Rocky.
I'm forgotten, Madam Chair.
I know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2194A. There are four simple things that this bill attempts to do, and they are somewhat administrative or technical changes. First, it replaces the OMIP definition of medical insurance with the definition contained within the insurance code and explicitly identifies particular types of coverage, and I think this is important, types of coverage that is excluded from the assessment that OMIP conducts every year. Secondly, it allows for majority voting board members to take action. Third, it clarifies limits on payment of enrollee premiums by public entities or health care providers. And fourth, it modifies the portability definition to conform with federal statutes. And let me just briefly, for I think most of you know what OMIP is. It's the state's high-risk pool. We provide coverage to about 15,000 to 16,000 Oregonians currently who are denied coverage because of pre-existing medical conditions or who have no portability options when they lose group coverage. So OMIP is an option for those folks losing portability coverage. Let me talk about each one of those four things just briefly and then be available to answer your question. First of all, we've had a different definition that's been in the insurance code. It's been kind of confusing to a lot of the carriers that are subject to assessment. So we wanted just to align our definition of medical insurance to that of the insurance division code. And secondly, to explicitly lay out those covered lives, underinsured products that are not subject to the assessment. For example, dental only, vision only, long-term care, those kinds of things that we don't count as covered lives when insurers pay the assessment. And just so you know how the assessment works, to remind you, each year we do an annual survey of all insurers in the state of Oregon that are licensed by DCBS, asking for the number of covered lives within Oregon that they provide coverage to. And our assessment, which is based on the losses of the pool, which runs run about 45% of our total expenditures are then assessed on a per covered life basis to all of those entities. And so we want to make sure, for example, if someone has Medicare, that's not subject to assessment, so they're not to include Medicare lives or Medicaid lives or CHIP lives. And that gets us, I think, into line with the insurance code. The second main piece is allows a majority of the voting board members to take action. We have 9 members on the board, and very often there are members that are absent, or once every 3 years we have a number of members as we go through the selection of a third-party administrator who have to declare a conflict of interest and aren't allowed to vote. And in those cases, we run into some problems because the way our statute reads now, we must have a majority of the board that votes in favor of any action that they take. So we always need 5 votes, even if you have only 4 members voting, and which is impossible to get 5 votes then. So what this does is really say the majority of the voting members, those people that are eligible to vote, we only need a majority of those rather than a majority of the whole board. The board supports this. It has been difficult at times to take action because of the limitation of having to have 5 of the 9 vote yes.
So, Rocky, if you have 3 members, then only 2 need to agree? Is that
Madam
what you're
Chair,
saying?
That would be correct.
Thank you.
The third is to clarify limits on payment of enrollee premiums by public entities or health care providers. Currently, our statutes say that if a person has the premiums paid or reimbursed by a public entity or a health care provider for the sole purpose of reducing the financial loss or obligation of the payer. And the problem we have is what does sole mean. So what this the technical change is to really remove the term sole. And basically say if they have a financial interest in paying the premiums for somebody, it doesn't have to be the sole reason, but they can't do that. And the best example I can give is in the past where we've had a transplant center say, well, you're uninsured and we're not going to pay for your transplant, but here's $500 a month for the next 3 months to pay your OMIP premium so you can get the transplant and we can get reimbursed. We've had cases where a surgeon has offered to pay the premiums for individuals, and we didn't view that as really the right thing because they were basically trying just to make sure that they got paid. There were cases where a public plan in the early 90s tried to move over their HIV folks to the high-risk pool and to pay the premiums for them, and we said, no, that was not right. So we're just really clarifying that it shouldn't be just for the sole purpose. It should be for just the purpose of reducing the financial burden of the person that's paying the premiums. The last item is to modify
Let's just add, I had a constituent who had a transplant to the Medicaid program. Actually, I think it was a liver transplant, and they don't allow 2 transplants of the liver under the Medicaid program. They only allow 1. She is very good health, hadn't been one of those who would have, lifestyle was not that would have destroyed her liver. Well, the liver wasn't quite the liver that she should have gotten. Long story short, we were able to work with your shop. We got the church to pay for OMIP.
That was good.
And she now is doing quite well with another.
Chair, if that's the case that I think I'm aware of, and Tom Jovic, our program manager, I think would agree with me. That was one where, from a medical viewpoint, a second transplant was warranted. Unfortunately, under the state Medicaid program, they were not able to get it, but our medical review said it was a perfect candidate, the reasons were legitimate, and that it would be something we would normally pay for. And so they did enroll, and with the help of people paying the premiums who didn't have a financial interest, and that's the difference.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard that she's doing well, too.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The final Little change is modifies portability eligibility to conform with federal law. Our current state statute says you have to be in the state 180 days. Federal statute says that's no. The whole idea of portability coverage is if you lose group coverage in Oregon and move to California, you have to have some portability coverage available to you. Likewise, if you move from Washington to Oregon, lost group coverage, we have to provide portability coverage. It's really a federal law, not just a little state portability program. So we have always administered it under the federal rules, and so we just want to get our state statute in conforming with federal statute.
Meaning what? So if a person goes to California...
Once you establish residence in a state, then if you're eligible for portability coverage, then every
but
state
I,
has
you need to explain
option.
What portability coverage means.
You lose group coverage, Madam Chair. And when you lose group coverage, you have a couple options. First of all, if it's a large employer, you have COBRA available to you.
Okay.
So you can go to COBRA. Once you exhaust COBRA, generally you have some portability option available to you, either through a high-risk pool in many states. In our state, it's really a dual system, either through the insurance carriers will provide portability coverage. We provide portability coverage to self-insured plans.
And are they usually quite expensive?
Portability coverage prices are based on either the small group or large group pricing premiums. So they're technically or theoretically they're the same cost for the benefits provided in the group market. And OMIP provides no surcharge for portability coverage for people coming in under that eligibility criteria.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, that's a quick summary. Be happy to answer any questions.
Not at this point, but let's see what everyone else says, and if you will hang tight. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With respect to the majority of voting board members, how often do you have a quorum problem, so to speak? If you have nine, how often would you not have at least five members?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, actually about once every 3 years when we start talking about our contracting with a third-party administrator. We have a number of representatives on the board who work for companies who do propose to be our third-party administrator, to administer our program, and they must obviously declare a conflict of interest and cannot participate in the deliberation discussions or the voting. And that you can have as many as three or four of our board members that end up having to withdraw from the vote and the discussion. So that's generally when that happens. It's about every 3 or 4 years. And the board has long supported this particular change to allow the remaining board members on a majority basis to make the decisions.
As a follow-up, a little unusual to allow a majority of those present to make decisions absent of a quorum. And I wondered, was it discussed on the House side with respect to this issue? It would make me more comfortable if you had requirement of a quorum, which would be five, and then the majority of the five.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, there is a requirement already in the statute that of a quorum, I believe.
Mr. Dover?
And actually,
that says the majority of voting members. So.
My name is Tom Dovick. I'm the operations manager for OMIP. Madam Chair, the statute change basically indicates majority of the voting members of the board constitutes a quorum.
Can you cite where in the statute?
It's page 2 under section 2, number 2, last two sentences.
Line 37
in the bold.
So we have to have a majority of the members to constitute a quorum of the voting members, which would be five. And then it's a majority of that quorum that has to vote in favor of a proposal in order for it to pass.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, you would have to have a majority of the board there. That is, a quorum would be identified as five, but it would be a majority of the voting members of that quorum.
So do you have requirements of who can be members of the board?
Madam Chair, yes, we do, and that is contained. Madam Chair, I can read this. Basically, there are 9 board members that are appointed by the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services, and to the extent possible, one of those must be a representative of a domestic insurance company licensed to transact insurance, one representative of a domestic not-for-profit healthcare service contractor, one representative of an HMO, one representative of reinsurers, two members.
Which insurers?
Reinsurers.
Oh, reinsurers.
And two members of the general public who are not associated with the medical profession, the hospital, or an insurer.
Two members.
Basically, right now, we have one doctor, provider. We have two consumer representatives. We have the director who appoints the board, also sits on the board. And then we have, I believe, 5 representatives of the insurance industry that are on the board, which includes one reinsurer.
So you don't, for your two general public members, is there a requirement that they not be affiliated with insurance?
They are consumer advocates.
They are consumer advocates.
Madam Chair.
Yep.
There is a dash to add one representative third-party administrator.
Excuse me.
That would make it an odd number then, an even number.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that's correct, and we'll let them talk to
that.
Yeah, okay. And then respond to that.
So theoretically, Rocky, you could have 5 board members, you have a quorum, you have an issue, 4 of them recuse themselves, and one person makes a decision, theoretically.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I probably would not have a job at the end of that vote.
But with what you're setting up, theoretically.
Technically or theoretically, yes. But they're public meetings. They have to go through the public announcement process. I mean, it's not where one person goes into a room and says, I'm by myself and I'm the quorum and I get the
vote. Well, no, I understand. But you mentioned that there are some decisions where members are required to recuse, and theoretically, you could have that happen. But
theoretically.
Madam Chair, when you have a majority of your board that has a conflict of interest, I recognize the contributions they make to the governance issues, but that seems to be a strange balance on the board. It strikes me as maybe inappropriate.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, in fact, there's the good and the bad to that. The good is that these are folks that assess themselves, $200 million a year. I mean, that what they have to do in terms of their responsibilities for funding the pool, and it's been absolutely amazing that in 19 years that I've been the head or the administrator for OMIP, and taking 2 votes a year with these carriers, we've had one time where one carrier said no to assessing themselves in one particular vote. It's how they have supported this pool, both through the pocketbook and through policy, has been tremendous. That said, the other piece to that is, yes, these folks represent companies that very often would like to administer the program, and it's appropriate that they declare a conflict of interest at that time and not participate. But I don't think that has ever in history of the pool interfered with any decisions on the day-to-day operations financially from a program standpoint of the pool. That's $90 to $100 million a year. I think I said $200 million. That's a biennium.
Remind us again, then, who is assessed? And first, who is assessed? And then what entities are not assessed? I need to have a review of that again.
Licensed insurers have covered lives that they provide insurance for. Any license insurer in the state of Oregon is basically assessed for the operations of the pool. There are some exceptions to that, and that is we do not include the covered lives of those insurers for Medicaid, and we're proposing state children's health insurance program, Medicare, disability insurance.
All that Medicare.
If you look at page 4 of the bill, kind of lays out in detail each one of the exemptions under an insurer. Now, these aren't insurers that are exempt. These are the covered lives administered
that would be,
by the insurer.
Yes. Okay.
And it kind of goes through the list there, and I can give it examples. Providence Health Plan provides Medicaid as part of our state's Medicaid program. And so we don't want to include those lives under the assessment. There's dental insurance. ODS has both health plan as an insurer, but they also have dental insurance, and we don't want to include the dental insurance. It would be a duplication. Kaiser has the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, and we don't want them to include those folks under the assessment. So each one of those is kind of an exception underneath an insurer. We have about 1.6 to 1.7 million people that are the covered lives of the insurers that we assess on an annual basis.
That we do assess.
That we do assess.
So
that does not include about 600,000 self-insured lives.
That's right. Okay, let's talk about self-insured. So self-insured entities are not covered.
They're not covered.
Yeah.
They're first of all, the self-insured is not an insurance company. They're not defined as an insurer, so they're not. They don't come under our assessment.
Yeah. Do they have? I want to say clients, insureds that would then come into the OMIT pool.
Madam Chair, yes, they do. Generally, through the portability coverage, about 14 to 15% of our members come in through portability, and that's generally provided to those that exhaust COBRA coverage coming off a self-insured plan.
But yet they do not. They are not assessed, even though their members, just like any other insurance.
That is correct, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 2192 that was proposed on the House side before Representative Greenlick's committee did propose that we assess the third-party administrators in order to capture those additional lives and to make it a more equitable participation in the assessment since everybody benefits. But very frankly, the concept did not go forward.
That's too bad. I feel strongly that TPAs should be assessed like to have a fair feel, but I know the politics of this is probably so strong that it would not go anywhere. But it is too bad because I think it's an equity issue. We're now decreasing, although I think you reassured me that with PEB going self-insured, they would still be assessed.
Madam Chair, that is correct. Under Oregon Insurance Code, there are public entities, non-ERISA plans, I believe it's called, that are still subject to the assessment even on if they're on a self-insured basis without a reinsurance arrangement. So we can directly assess those. And there are some like Multnomah County.
Cities, counties,
school districts.
And had PEB ever said that they would voluntarily be assessed if they ever went self-insured?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, going over the last 6 or 7 years, probably back to 2002 when we first started talking about going self-insured for PEB, the board did on a number of occasions talk about participating in the assessment. It was not their intent to pull back out of the assessment if they went to a self-insured basis. At that time, we didn't know that technically they came under the law that would require them to pay the assessment. So there was always an affirmative position that the board was taking to participate in the assessment. And in fact, this last 2 years, we have two self-insured plans, Providence Health Plans and Samaritan Health Services, and PEB continued to pay the assessment under those two self-insured plans, feeling it was their obligation as part of the larger pool.
How easy would it be for you to give us information of the various trusts and self-insured and from each one, whether it's Nike or Intel or Clackamas County, and how many of their people end up in our OMIT pool?
Madam Chair,
without being assessed,
I'll ask Ms. Jovan.
Is that easy or not?
That's very difficult.
Yeah, Madam Chair, that is very difficult. We don't necessarily get the information that identifies the particular self-insured entity a person has come from when they come to us for portability.
Okay. But you had said something like 14-15%.
Madam Chair, 14 or 15% come into the pool under the portability definition of eligibility. But then you also have a large number of people who may decline their portability or their COBRA coverage because of the expense of COBRA coverage, and who then come in under the medical eligibility side. And that we also believe we get a number of folks from self-insured plans from.
Although we're getting some federal stimulus money to help with COBRA right now, aren't we?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
I think we just passed a bill.
Those that are eligible for that.
All right. Further discussion? Very complicated issue. I think stay tuned and we'll see what these other people have to say. All right, John Powell and Doug Barber.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug Barber. I'm here today wearing two hats. One is the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, health insurance agents throughout the state. Also here on behalf of the Hospital Association. We are strong supporters of the of OMIP and the high-risk pool. We believe that everyone benefits from that pool, and everyone ought to participate in that pool and should support it. As Rocky described, you know, currently it's only the commercial insurers who bear the burden of the OMIP assessment, which means that it's individuals, small businesses, and apparently the municipal entities, the public entities that are also included in that. But as he said, there are 600,000 people with insurance in the state who do not contribute to the OMIP pool. And as we see that assessment grow, it's becoming an increased burden on small businesses. Rocky mentioned that OMIP did propose a solution on the House side earlier this session. We would encourage the committee to take another look at that proposal. Expanding the pool.
That's 2162.
2192. To expand that pool of those who pay the assessment by including the self-insureds and the union trusts. The policy issue for OMIP, I think, is very similar to the discussion that you had in that joint hearing with the House Health Committee around premium tax versus claims tax. Question is, how broadly is the assessment going to be made? Who's going to contribute to the greater good? Tuesday afternoon at your late afternoon committee meeting, Senator Bates bemoaned the fact that once again it looks like we are going to leave federal money on the table for the Oregon Health Plan because the way the decisions that are being made around the premium tax means that the pool of those who pay is shrinking. You talked about PEB's recent decision to go self-insured. That's 120,000 lives out of the premium tax.
Although I think we just had Rocky King tell us that they will be assessed
for OMIP.
But for OMIP, that, but for not for the provider. Oh.
Not the premium tax, as I understand
not
it. Now there may be somebody who can correct that, but I've asked and I've received no assurance that they would be included. And just my back-of-the-envelope calculations. 120,000 people, if you assume a premium of $1,000 a month, and that's an assumption, 1% premium tax is $10 per member per month. That's $1.2 million per month that will not go to healthy kids. That's $14 million a year, $28 million per biennium, and that's just the state share. The federal matching funds for that would be more than three times that, given the current healthy kids matching rate. That means $100 million will be left on the table because of that one decision by PEB. And at Tuesday's, at your hearing on Tuesday morning, Steve Petrozelli from Willamette Dental sort of made a side comment about how he thinks it, within 2 years they may be the only large business left that's buying commercial insurance. Because what I'm hearing from the agents who I work with and from the large businesses I work with is that you are going to see an avalanche of large companies go self-insured within the next 2 years. By going self-insured, they don't have to pay the insurance mandates. They don't have to cover insurance mandates in their package. They don't have to pay the OMIP assessment. They don't have to pay the premium tax. So it's policy decisions here that will help drive that movement. So we think that shrinking pool of, you know, individuals and small businesses that are going to bear the burden of the premium tax for healthy kids and bear the burden of the OMIP tax to pay for the high-risk pool is going to create a serious problem, and it's going to put us in a position where we're not going to be able to achieve the goals that we want, either in healthy kids or in the high-risk pool. So we strongly suggest that the committee take another look at the proposal that Rocky had on the House side to broaden the assessment for the high-risk pool. Everybody benefits from that assessment. Everybody should pay. Thank you very much.
It's a very volatile topic, very political topic, and the forces that be may not allow this. I do feel it is the right thing to do, but whether there's the political will in this body is another issue. So we will, I would like to keep it alive by talking with the individual members, but let's get back to the guts of the bill that came over. Are you in favor of the bill as it came over?
I believe that they are technical changes, as Rocky indicated, and yes, we would support those technical changes.
And thank you for your comments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I would simply agree with Mr. Barber's testimony and the comments of the chair. He's right. You're right. I don't think the political will exists in the building to broaden the assessment this session. I think it's too bad, not only on the OMIP assessment, but on the premium tax as well, because I don't think either is sustainable. I think we're headed for a wall or a cliff, and we're going at full speed, and we're just going to go over it. And that will be a sad day, I think, for a system that guarantees access to health insurance for everybody in Oregon. And that's in the law right now. Everybody in Oregon can get insurance. The question is affordability. And without that broader approach, both in the OMIP assessment and in the premium tax, as Mr. Barber pointed out, people will avoid that. Not because they're evil people. It's they're looking after their own interests.
The bottom line.
And that's what tax policy does, and that's what any kind of assessment policy does. We will be advocating one amendment, Madam Chair, to the bill, and it will be on page 4 at the top. There's a sentence in there that says reinsurers may be subject to the assessment as required by the board. And that sentence doesn't make sense when you compare it to the definition of insurer. And under the definition of insurer, any reinsurer reinsuring medical insurance in the state is an insurer. And then this that sentence says reinsurers may be subject to the assessment. Well, they are subject to the assessment based on the definition of insurer. So that sentence doesn't make any sense. And I just found this out at 10:05 p.m. last night. So I didn't have anything prepared quite yet.
If you work with Mr. Shook, yeah, and we have a Representative Nolan here, and I don't want to take up any more of her time. So if you will just stay put, and let's have her come and give her few words, and then you can come back if you haven't finished your testimony. Representative Nolan.
To 3055.
Pardon?
She has to gavel in.
Oh, right. You're for another bill, not
right.
This bill.
Right.
I didn't read the note carefully. So let's close the public hearing on 2194 and open a public hearing on 3055. Sorry, I thought it was for this bill.
Madam Chair, I would be happy to wait if you'd rather, but...
No, you need to go off and do good things. Would you want to describe the bill?
Madam Chair, House Bill 3055 prohibits any person other than anatomical gift donor or parent of a minor donor from revoking anatomical gift made by designation or driver's license or state identification card.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I appreciate your hearing this bill. This is a bill that had broad support.
Introduce yourself.
Oh, thank you. Yes. I'm Mary Nolan. I am the state representative for District 36, which is Southwest Portland. Thank you for hearing this bill. This is a bill that had broad support in the House, and I recommend it to you as a way of helping modestly increase the availability of organs for transplant in emergency situations. I brought this bill on behalf of a woman who was a constituent of mine, but who got redrawn out of my district, but who whose idea is still worth pursuing. And she is here to testify when you actually open the hearing later, Carol Studeman. And she has a compelling family story to tell you. It resonated with me because there were instances where a person's clear intent, the D on the back of your driver's license, meant that you wanted your organs to be, I have one on the back of mine, Senator Cruz, as well, meant that should your body show up in an ER room and not make it, you wanted someone else to benefit from your organs.
Can I have your body?
There were times when perhaps a not very close relative or someone else would show up and not be ready to let go, putting the medical personnel in a situation where they were struggling between the intention of the deceased and a grieving family who maybe wasn't aware of the anatomical gift. And they were in a position of having to basically make a choice. This law, if it becomes law, would say that choice has been made, and no one can overrule my choice to make an anatomical gift except me. In the case of my daughter, who's a minor, the parent of that minor could make a choice to change it, but a hospital personnel or someone else in the emergency room can't make that decision on our behalf. It's surprising that it's necessary, mm-hmm. but apparently it is, and that's the purpose of this bill. We think it will help modestly increase the availability of cadaver organs, and that should help, again, reduce the need for live donors to donate kidneys, for example, or other organs, because the supply of cadaver organs will be increased. And I hope you will join the House in supporting it. My co-sponsor can speak to you a bit about it when, if you have questions about it, Senator Bates and I brought this bill to your attention.
Great. I appreciate your attention, and thank you for accommodating me out of order.
No problem. Thank you. Close the public hearing on 3055 and reopen public hearing on 2194. Mr. Powell, are you finished? Or you are? All right. Let's Bob Shipwreck, Jonathan Eames, and Alana.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Are the A5 or the... Are the A2s... Do the A2s address the issue you brought up, or are we looking at another amendment?
No, yes.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. No, the A2s are not our amendments,
okay.
And we don't necessarily favor them either.
See why.
No on dash twos. Okay, got that. Okay, now Bob Shipwreck.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames here with PacWest Communications, and on behalf of ANI Benefit Administrators, a standalone third-party administrator. And we're here to offer some amendments to 2194, the -2 A2 amendments. And, you know, this committee hearing has changed a little bit, or changed the discussion to talk about another House Bill 2192, which actually, although we may disagree with 2192, illustrates the point of what our amendments are actually asking for. There's two parts to the amendments. I'll speak to one of them, and Ms. Guinea here on my right will talk about the second piece. But the first piece is to actually add a third-party administrator onto the board of OMIP. It doesn't actually add another person, Senator Morissette. It actually just adds, as a designee, a third-party administrator. And as this hearing has illustrated, while a third-party administrator is not subject to the assessment, many of the decisions and many of the discussions that have happened on OMIP and on the board affect third-party administrators. And the language may be refined a bit more to actually say a standalone third-party administrator, because as Mr. Powell had mentioned previously, Regents actually has a third-party administrator as well as their core business, which is not self-insured. And a standalone third-party administrator, the decisions that are being made and the votes that are being taken on the OMIP board would affect, or could affect, a standalone third-party administrator. When the discussions began at the beginning of this legislative session about OMIP and the troubles funding OMIP, the 2192 came up as a House Bill 2192 came up as a suggestion, as a solution, and you know, frankly, in talking with our clients, they were a bit surprised that this was coming up, and it would have very substantially affected their business and potentially put a number of third-party administrators out of business, because to understand, third-party administrators are not insurers, but they do represent and they do the accounting for a number of self-insured plans. And so the assessment would have been on third-party administrators, which we believe actually violates ERISA, but that's another discussion and I don't want to get into that today. But because of that, it wasn't assessing the actual self-insured plan, it was assessing the third-party administrators. So you can see how this discussion today and what we're proposing as an amendment, which may be refined, and we had talked about this early on in the session with Tom, because Rocky had been out with a back injury, but with Tom about this issue, and it was a long time ago. But this is important, because the decisions that OMIP are making could substantially affect a third-party administrator's ability to operate here in Oregon. So that's the first part of the amendment. I'll let Ms. Guinea from the AFL talk about the second part of the amendment, unless there's any questions.
For the record, my name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. The second part of the amendment would affect the list, which I believe is on page 4 of the bill, of groups that are not subject to the OMIP assessment. It would add to that list ERISA-regulated I'm getting the exact language right here, health trust subject to federal regulation under the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, that is the ERISA. This is something that is already the policy of OMIP. They have testified to that in discussions over past bills. We have had discussions with them about that this year. This would just put that into statute. There have been a lot of discussions this session about whether or not ERISA-regulated health trusts can be assessed. The general consensus is that legally they cannot be assessed, and by putting it into statute, we're just hoping to free up the time that has been spent on this discussion and use it towards looking at how we can fund health care in ways that are federally legal. Like I said, it's something that is the policy right now. This would just be codifying that policy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades Council. I'm here this morning to lend my support to the Dash 2 amendments. We think this would clarify the existing policy of the state. And I want to just add as an aside that the third-party administrators that we employ, I use them for technical advice. I think they would bring something to the board, the OMIP, because of their extensive understanding, knowledge, and utilization of the federal rules, as well as some of the state issues. So I think it would be a positive addition to OMIP to have a person who would be very knowledgeable about health care, and it would be good for the state. So I'd stop there.
Yes, Senator Morrison.
Okay, third-party administrators are not insurance companies, therefore they cannot be included in anything, but they do represent the private, or the self-insured, who are not assessed for the OMIP program. Have other private insurance companies discussed, well, you may not know this, PEB is choosing to be. Okay, that's okay. Thank you. One other thing.
Yeah.
Refresh my memory in terms of ERISA and why their rules prohibit the assessment. Or you cite a court case, and you gave me a letter from an attorney.
Right.
That. Do you have any? We can do this later. We can review that, but I am interested again in the definitive court decision concerning ERISA and the self-insured.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I'd be very happy to follow up with you with a lawyer to discuss exactly why ERISA preempts any regulation on the state level. This is obviously in the broader discussion of whether you can assess the ERISA plans, but there are numerous federal laws around this, and I don't want to.
I understand that, but the implications do affect OMIP. Potentially, and so on.
Absolutely.
And that would be nice to expand that pool.
Be very happy to.
And I'll have to be frank with you. The only way I would accept the Dash 2s is if everyone would be subject to all mandates, OMIP assessment, and the premium tax assessment, because that is truly in the best interests of Oregonians. Especially our most vulnerable. And again,
Madam Chair, Bob Shiprack. I am no ERISA attorney. However, I've been around this issue for some time, and I would just ask the committee to look at the legal opinions. Congress in 1974, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, decided that there needed to be federal legislation to protect workers across the country. And they would not be subject to state mandates. They wouldn't be subject to certain assessments, things like that. I don't know what all was going on back in 1974, but there must have been some bad things going on, or President Nixon wouldn't have signed the bill. So please take a look at those issues. I would also, as a construction worker, these are really not insurance. These are health trusts. We can actually bank our hours. I can be off work for months and still have coverage because I've got an hour bank that's set up. It's not an insurance company. I don't know if my union still allows it, but frankly, because these are health trusts and not an insurance company, we used to be able to elect to have the money come out of the trust directly to the employee, who then could pay the provider. It's still allowed, although I think some of the trusts have said, well, we'll just send the money directly to the provider. That gives you an idea, though, that these are a little bit different type of an animal. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, and I look at it from a different perspective, because I think you have developed a very good system for your workers, but there's a disparity between what your workers have and what most of the Oregonians have. And that's where I want coverage for everyone. I would like to see the most vulnerable. And the only way we can get everyone covered is if everyone in the state comes to the plate to offer something to help. And if you want to be, and I hate to say this, selfish enough just to protect your own, maybe that's how it should be. I just look at it a little bit differently.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I understand your concern. But I urge you to look at this specific amendment as something separate from the debate about who should be assessed and who shouldn't. This self-insured plans are a major part of the healthcare delivery system here in Oregon. And so when we're talking about this specific amendment, which is dealing with having a third party administrator on the board, as you have mentioned, not only people that become unemployed, but other people come onto the OMIP board, these are, you know, they represent a significant portion of those who are receiving health care in the state. And so I understand the argument, and I understand your position. That's not what we're trying to define here. We're not trying to define or structure or have that debate. This is simply about offering a person onto a board that deals with health care in Oregon for everybody. Okay, this high-risk pool is for everybody, and the taxes that everybody here pays, whether you're part of a self-insured plan or not, do go to support that. That's what this is about. And I'd like to separate that out, because I don't want it to be about, oh, well, these folks aren't getting... A third-party administrator is not delivering the health care. You know, they are representative of groups that are delivering the health care. So I want that to be understood. That's not what we're trying to do here. We're trying to get a representative who represents a large portion of those who are delivering health care in the state to be on the OMIP board.
Thank you very much. All right, we will be continuing this conversation. Tom Holt, I think, wanted to talk to the amendment.
I understand it. Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Morissette.
I just want to make an observation. It's interesting because I used to say that I have said that insurance companies don't provide health care, but sometimes they stand away in the way of it. By rejecting mandates. Insurance companies are actually pretty good about mandates. I'm carrying two bills that will be mandates, so to speak, that the insurance companies are not opposed to. So it's the self-insured who don't even have to worry about mandates, which is interesting. Ironically. Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I just want to speak briefly about the amendment. I think there's a great Yiddish word to describe the amendment, chutzpah. The idea of putting an additional member or designation of a TPA on the board when they are not willing to pony up on the assessment, I think, is outrageous. But I do want to clarify also the record on ERISA. While there are certainly lawyers on both sides of this issue, I would point out that in the context of the discussion on the premium tax, the Hospital Association secured an opinion from one of the leading law firms in the country on this issue. We purposely went to a firm that specializes in ERISA challenges at the state level, so they would be the ones who would be able to identify vulnerabilities in ERISA-type issues at a state level. Be happy to provide to the committee a copy of the same letter I think we provided to the Health Committee on this subject that I think would clarify that the state can indeed impose assessments in this area. It is not the same animal as a regulation of the benefit. So, you know, for instance, mandates. Mandates are clearly exempt under ERISA, but fees are not, and so I'd be happy to provide you with that information. So we would obviously oppose both elements of the amendment and heartily concur with the comments that you all have just made.
Thank you very much, Tom. Is there any other Rocky, please come forward.
Madam Chair, again for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. And for the record, I just wanted to say that we are opposed to the -2 amendments. First of all, we think that we have broad representation on the board. In fact, we have a reinsurer representative that does represent a large number of self-insured plans who purchase stop-loss coverage and who do participate because of that stop-loss coverage in the assessment. And secondly, we have between the consumer advocates, providers, and many of the insurers, also third-party administrators. All of our meetings are open to the public. People are welcome to participate. It is interesting that the interest that is being shown now in participating in those discussions only when the dollar's on the table, because for 19 years that we haven't heard a request to really be a part of that process. The second piece, though, in terms of adding the definition for excluded, and I just got this amendment yesterday, the exclusion from the assessment, health trust subject to federal regulation. This is kind of like asking somebody to wear suspenders when they already have a belt on. We have in our statute already something that says that if it's preempted by ERISA, you're not going to be assessed. That's the first piece. The second is the place they want to add this is a definition of the kinds of covered lives under an insurer. Well, an insurer doesn't have a Taft-Hartley trust under its covered lives because they don't provide it. That is an insurance. So it just does not make sense to put that definition under the definition of excluded covered lives. They're not talking about covered lives. They're talking about self-insured plan, and that's different. So we oppose both of those.
Thank you, Rocky, very much. Have a good vacation. He's leaving at 11. All righty. With that, this will be coming back. I'm not sure what form or what amendments, but we will close the public hearing on 2194, and I would like to open a public hearing on 3055. And let's call, I think you already read it.
Mm-hmm.
So is it Mary Jane Hunt and Barbara Thompson?
Whew, this is interesting. Mm-hmm.
This and
one? No.
Carol Studeman?
They want to be on the board even though they aren't assessed.
Yeah, I mean, you're right.
Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Jane Hunt, Executive Director of Donate Life Northwest. Pleased to be here today in support of House Bill 3055. We are the organization that has, for the last 30-some years, promoted organ and tissue donation in our state. We were instrumental in launching the registry in 2007. We are very pleased that this bill specifically clarifies and significantly
honors an individual's wish and intent to be a donor. And obviously, on behalf of our procurement organizations that we work together throughout the community, which includes the Community Tissue Services, the Lions Eye Bank of Oregon, Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, we support this bill.
Thank you. And since we passed legislation in 2007, do you have any results from if that bill even made any difference?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, it definitely did. Basically, the launching of the registry brought in all of the information from DMV, so anyone with the driver's license or ID card, all of that information is in one single registry. If you didn't or haven't had that on your driver's license or permit ID card, you can go online, independently register, or if you do not have that access, you have ability to do it through paper form. So it has streamlined the information, first of all, and for the most part, it has given the agencies who need that information that access 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we are very proud of the 2 million people who are in the donor registry.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Barbara Thompson, a clinical manager at Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank. I don't really have anything new or different. I'm just here to lend my support to Mary Jane's comments and to Carol's comments that are coming next, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Our agency, in response to your question directed to Mary Jane, has certainly found that the prior legislation makes a huge difference in our approach with families and with patients in hospitals who have the potential to become organ donors. We access their information regarding their donor status and use that as part of our approach with staff and families. And it makes a great deal of difference to everyone to know that someone's loved one has made the decision to become a donor. And this bill will add, I believe, even though it already exists in a certain form in the other legislation, it really lends strength to the donor's rights because once they're gone, and then there's the D on the license, there can be questions. And so this will just help ensure that their rights to become a donor are honored. Excellent. So every hospital has access to this registry? Is that how it is?
The hospitals, no, but the procurement agencies do.
And so what is a procurement agency?
That would be us, as well as the Lions Eye Bank and Community Tissue Services. Pacific Northwest Transplant Bank, we're the organ recovery, organ procurement agency, Lions Eye Bank, for eye donation, and Community Tissue Services for tissue donation.
So if we have someone who's at end of life and is in the hospital and some quick decisions have to be made, how do they know what to do if they don't know if this particular
person... The procurement
person,
agencies?
No, the hospitals.
Well, the hospitals, there are other federal laws that require that hospitals call a procurement agency with every hospital death or impending death.
Okay.
Yes.
What about an accident where there are lives lost and immediately they go to the mortuary?
Actually, we have the cooperation with the medical examiner's office regard, too.
Okay.
Yes.
Excellent.
So then immediately they can find out, an accident, the body is brought in to be dealt with, and what happens?
They call, there's actually a 1-800 number that accesses all three procurement agencies.
I see.
So one of us is at that point paged and called 24/7 to respond to that referral to then start the process of assessing whether or not there is something that
So every licensed, that's with the medical examiner.
Correct.
Okay.
So, and with the hospitals, it's
the hospital's not involved. The body is taken from the accident scene. Did they go to the hospital they go to the mortuary.
If their dad.
Right, right. So so then the mortuary must notify someone to procure you. Okay.
Correct.
So that's part of their licensing.
Is there any,
if there are any situation where you would not be notified in a death?
No.
Okay.
I was just curious, Madam Chair, because, I mean, I'm 2 years away from a new card, but you can't even really read that anymore. And I just want to make sure that...
it's on the DMV record.
And he's not going to get my body.
I don't want that.
That kind of scared me. I'm thinking, my God, maybe I better rethink this whole thing.
I don't want his limbs that can take me out.
Barbara, does every hospital have the capability of harvesting organs locally, or do they have to go get a surgeon who can come in and harvest?
Yep. The recovery of organs is done by the transplant teams through our agency and then through the Lions Eye Bank or Community Tissue Services, depending on what we're talking about. So it's not really a hospital-based process. It's a procurement organization-based process.
So they would send their surgeons into your into the local hospital to harvest and take the organs?
Correct.
Okay. Or mortuary, as Senator Moore said.
Yes.
Okay, because timing is a critical element here. So I'm assuming you have regional folks to do the regional things, because you aren't going to send somebody from Portland to Klamath Falls or Baker City, obviously, to do the harvesting, or does is that the way it...
Well, when the patient dies in the hospital, then our procurement team goes to wherever that patient is, actually all through the state. So we're our donor service area is federally mandated, and we cover all of Oregon and Southwest Washington and Western Idaho. So we go to wherever the patient is, and we do the process there at the hospital. And then the surgeons who are recovering organs specifically fly from wherever the transplant is going to happen. They fly or drive or whatever it takes to get wherever the donor patient is, they go there. And then the organs are recovered there and taken to where they're going to be transplanted. So say, for example, a kidney donor is in a hospital in Salem. The kidney transplant center in, there are two of them in Oregon. They're both based in Portland. So the surgical recovery teams come from Portland to Salem Hospital and do the recovery of the organs there. Then they're taken back right away because, like as you noticed, there are time issues with that. They need to get transplanted within a certain number of hours depending on which organs they are, so they're taken right away to the transplant centers.
I'm curious what your region would include part of Washington, part of Idaho. Is the regionalization based on
population?
On population, yeah. And not on, because I was assuming there would probably be a transplant center in Boise.
Yeah, actually there isn't.
There is
no, there are no transplant centers in Idaho. Mm. So Salt Lake City serves the eastern.
Oh, probably.
Yeah, the
probably eastern Idaho and Montana,
Idaho.
Wyoming.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
Carol. Madam Chair, I'm Carol Studenman of Southwest Portland. I have a little personal experience with the donation process. My nephew Graham was born 11 years ago with kidney problems, and when he was 5 years old, he was put on the transplant list. He started dialysis, and our family understood that a third of the people on the waiting list die before they get an organ donation, and my dear husband stepped up to volunteer to donate a kidney to him, and Graham's doing great now. He's 11, and unfortunately my husband died as a result of the surgery. So we understand this happened in Oklahoma, so nobody in Oregon did this. So our family understands very deeply the pressure of waiting for being on the list and the fear that, you know, you're not going to make it. But also then experiencing the live donation process. My husband was lied to by doctors who were, you know,
anxious to get a kidney for Graham, mm-hmm. and they greatly minimized the risks. My husband would have never done this surgery if he'd understood that, you know, about 1,700 donors die. He would have walked away from that quickly, and he was told it was more like 1 in billions die. Mm-hmm. We understand how interconnected the whole process is, and if you put pressure on one part of the process, it can affect the other end of it. So our family supports this bill because it strengthens the position of these women when they go to procure donations to be able to walk in and say, this decision was made by your loved one. Do you have any questions? Rather than, what do you want to do? And kind of having the door open to someone say, we don't want to do that. It strengthens all of our decisions to be a part of the registry or to put a D on our driver's license. And just, it's a subtle, it feels like a subtle rephrasing of the question, but it makes all the difference. And I feel that it puts the state of Oregon behind that rephrasing that says our entire community supports this decision that a person has made. And it's very important, and we hope that you'll support the bill. Thank you.
It takes a lot of courage to come and testify regarding such actually a happy and yet a very tragic event in your life, so I appreciate that, and I'm certainly happy to move this bill if it's the will of the committee. Is there any other discussion?
It's the will of the committee.
Yeah. Okay. All right. If there's no further discussion, any other comments?
Thank you.
I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3055 and open a work session on House Bill 3055.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3055 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3055 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and Senator Bates will carry the bill, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3055 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2058. And we already heard about that, and I'd like to have Holly Mercer please come forward.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Holly Mercer. I'm Executive Director of the Board of Nursing. I'm here in support of the concept of House Bill 2058. We at the Board of Nursing actually did not see some technical changes that need to be made on this bill. Chair Mona Sanderson, in fact, yesterday found one that we feel is very important to change, and that's reducing the restrictions on the public members and to make it similar to the language for the other boards. I'm not sure what the history is, Chair Mona Sanderson. I would like to have a little time to discuss this with the governor's office and the ONA to see if they know of the history of why that additional restriction was put on our public members. Also, we've noticed that language...
And let's, for the committee, let's have them go to,
Page 8, line 32 through 34, correct?
That's correct. So the public members and any person who is a spouse, domestic partner, child, parent, or sibling of a public employee may not be employed as a health professional or in any health-related industry. And it's in...
That's a broad sweep.
Yeah, and in any health-related industry is huge. And I think the intent of Representative Greenlick, with all the good work that he did on the bill, was, and if you look at each other board, it always... It combines it to the actual members that are covered.
In other words, the public members shouldn't be nurses.
That's correct. And that's correct. And as I pointed out, there is another bill that will come before you that actually removed an LPN and added a certified nursing assistant to the board. So eventually, all this language probably needs to be made consistent, depending on, you know, how that bill fares. So there's another section of this bill, however, that I think needs to be brought into consistency, and it's right below that. It's in sub D on same page,
lines 35 through 37. When this was amended, I believe that the language that is similar to the other boards, that the governor may want to consider geographic areas and ethnic groups, I don't believe this was put back in. So I think that's also an additional, you know, conversation.
Because I know that was the intent of Representative Greenlink, because if you look at the other, they made sure that that was a requirement. Well, no. Geographic areas, I guess, no, it was actually in the regular.
Yes, it was.
So if you look on page 4, lines 42 and 43, those are the things that should be put back in that evidently didn't go back.
That's correct.
Okay.
So
would you work with the administrator and with amendments?
I certainly will.
Regarding that?
I certainly will.
So those were the only, I went through this bill very carefully because I had gone to a couple of Representative Greenlink's interim committees on this issue, and they really did work hard on trying to standardize it, and I think the quality is quite good. I did have a question regarding retirees, at least in the Board of Nursing, since we don't really have any other boards here, with the Board of Nursing, what happens with retirees? They would be considered what? Just a professional, or could they be a public member?
You know, Chairman Ms. Anderson, that's an interesting question. Tomorrow, in fact, we have a meeting with a group of nurses who want to clarify their status as retired nurses. I will have to do some research on that and get back to the committee. I think it's an interesting question. There is some frustration with nurses who want to continue to be nurses but don't want to be in a clinical active practice and meet the practice hour, so we're going to work with them.
Excellent.
And coincidentally, we do have a meeting with them tomorrow.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, I think retirees, especially now with the health care crisis, that we have to look at all of our retirees and making it easier for them to fill in spots that they would like to contribute to and not make it onerous, and I'm glad that the Board of Nursing is looking at that.
We have, you know, practice hour requirements, but we have a very broad definition of what practice is for nurses, and so I would just like to see that conversation take place. Well, we're going to tomorrow, and we'll see what the outcome is, but they're anxious for some clarification.
Excellent. Any other discussion on this bill?
Madam Chair, yeah. Just I think if you look at the section dealing with the medical board, there may be some similar concerns.
There is, absolutely, and so we'll need to bring
it. And it may be through all of them, and just some of the reordering of who is on, and I'm not quite sure why.
Can we bring the OMA up here, too? And we will point it out to you. We will just point it out to you so that you can then go back to your group. And because if you look on page 6, yeah, bring the bill, because these are the only two entities that have this. That's all right. I'll let you know, and someone will write this down for you. On page 6 of the bill, under on line 13, basically starts on 11, they changed it, but evidently a public member.
I mean, that's current law, but
yeah,
I'm
it's current law, and so that's why I was hoping that maybe we could change it for the nursing board, and if OMA felt it was appropriate, unless you can come up with some history as to why it has to be someone completely removed from any health-related industry. But the way our health-related industry, that cuts out maybe some valuable public members.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd like a read from both the OMA and the OMB on the entirety of Section 5.
Madam Chair, Brian Behringer with the Oregon Medical Association. We'd be happy to take this back, take a look, see if we can find the history and connect with the board as well, and we'll bring that back to you.
And could you contact Mr. Shook, contact the Board of it's a new word now, Oregon Medical Board, to look at Section 5 with the new language and point out on line 13 why that we have that they cannot be in any health-related industry, and because all the other boards except for the nursing board as well as the medical board just limit it to the professions that are actually licensed through the board.
Yeah, I mean, Madam Chair, we've got a lot of boards in this bill, and not to disparage any of them, but two of them are probably more significant than the others, and have been functioning, I think, in a very good way. And so I just want to make sure we aren't potentially doing damage by restructuring either the Board of Nursing or the Medical Board. So.
Great.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out on page 5, just scanning over Section 5, we may have inconsistency. And look at, if you would, line 39 through 41. It's talking about public members. And then I believe does limit that to the licensee.
No, it does.
So I think it might just be, you know, some drafting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the stuff I was looking at. That just
that's right. It is. That's right. Because I did have that, and then I didn't. Yeah. So it's inconsistent with line 13. So
Brian, you got to earn your paycheck now.
Yeah.
We'll take a look.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. If there's no further discussion, no one else is here to testify, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2058, and colleagues, we're adjourned.